Thanks for listening, and welcome to Zen and Java.
It happened in 1995. The network age was born. And look what happened with respect to productivity. The small increase in productivity gives rise to a huge increase in output over a period of time, leaving behind in its wake wealth, wealth creation. And I'm not talking dot-com madness here. I'm talking true wealth, productivity, i.e. doing more with less. That's what the network age is all about. And I believe we took that step in 1995. That's why I believe, if there's hope for us, it's right here.
The advent of the network age has created as much confusion as it has opportunity. Witness the dot-com debacle of the spring of 2001. When viewed in retrospect, the collapse of speculative dot-com entities can be seen to be a natural shakeout which would inevitably occur during the exploration process of any new competitive landscape, especially one with the economic potential of the Internet. During the heyday period between early 1998 and the fall of 2000, companies were going public, enjoying what seemed to be very lucrative IPOs on NASDAQ, with little more than a catchy URL and a slick business plan. The www.whatever.com land grab was fueled by the dramatic growth of the Internet itself, which is still growing, and the mistaken belief that there was a limited resource that could opportunistically be claimed, not unlike mining claims during the gold rush periods of 19th century North America. As we have learned, the value of the network cannot be denied. But to believe that a catchy URL is the key to future wealth is naive indeed. One day, URLs too will be a thing of the past as we invent other digital metaphors to better access information. These are the early lessons of the network age. Because of the sometimes non-intuitive nature of the network metaphor, it can be useful to explain software architecture from a conceptual basis which is well-grounded otherwise. David Gelernter of Yale University wrote the book Mirror Worlds in 1991 to metaphorically describe such an architecture for network software development.
David Gelernter, in 1991, now notice 1991, this is before this explosion of internet activity took place. He envisioned this. He thought of this. What if? He asked, what if? What if?
What if
you could look into your computer screen and actually see a semblance of reality in real time? Anything that we would carry to measure, anything that would have a barcode or URL or anything like that, anything with an address, anything with a number, anything we would bother to track.
What if everything that we care about could be reflected in software and represented to you in a shoebox on your desk? What if the world...
What if you could look at that and in real time mirror that? In reality, would that have value?
The Mirror Worlds metaphor, a virtual reality software framework comprised of objects which represent actual physical objects and their relationships, an actual virtual reality, is useful to both communicate and explore the potential of a global network of increasingly pervasive intelligent devices. Such a mirror, comprised of objects at the level of granularity as typified by the intelligent light bulb, would be valuable indeed.
What if you could look at that and in real time mirror that? In reality, would that have value? Probably. Probably have a great deal of value. If you look at it from the perspective of the whole and all those hot spots in human activities in which we, you know, dissipate all of the resources, the abundant resources on this planet, off into the ether, off into entropy space. You stop and think about it from that perspective, yeah, that might have considerable value.
Imagine the possibilities. What if you could utilize all of the resources that are latent in networks today? Would that have value? Of course it would.
What if we could do that? Would that be of value? Would that give you anything? And according to Gelernter, and I happen to agree with him, yeah, that would give us a whole lot of stuff. Just imagine the possibilities of mirror worlds. What if, I mean, just in terms of optimization for commuting, what if you knew, not just a guess or somebody's traffic report, but you could actually go online or the equivalent of that in your automobile and see what the traffic flow looked like? What if you could keep track of where your children were at any moment? Would that be of value? Maybe so.
Maybe so. Maybe something like this could go a long way to help us address some of these issues that we're facing in our world today. Some of these very acutely important issues that we must face as a species if we are to survive.
The progress we make in the network age, as measured by the global adoption rate of certain key network technologies, will likely be considerable if a mirror world's approach as a simplifying metaphor is utilized. While ours may or may not be the only species to evolve capable of the rational utilization of tools, our proficiency at it cannot be disputed. Arguably, our collective ability to model physical processes has yielded not only the great wealth production machinery of the industrial age, but has also served to bootstrap key elements of the network age. But models, while useful, are nonetheless models.
I want to talk about this, the S-curve. Now, you know this. I know you know this. This is a model that we use as human beings to understand reality. There are so many things in nature, so many things in our human activities, so many things that fall into models just like this. Yes? Product adoption curves, populations, all kinds of things. For example, we might look at the sale of home computers. We might look at the penetration rate of cell phones. We might look at internet and online services and judge how successful we are being based on where they fit in the curve. And we can say, yeah, we understand now because of the penetration of these kinds of things. We understand reality a little bit better. We understand our world. We know what we're doing as business. We can go home. We can sleep at night. We can feel good about it. But by focusing on these things, I claim it's a lot like walking into a room blindfolded. You walk into a room blindfolded. I'll give you one data point. You touch that elephant and tell me what it is. Can you do it? What if you touch the ear or the trunk or the leg or the tail? I mean, you're going to get a different picture depending on what data point you select, right? I claim that the models that we use to understand our world are a lot like touching an elephant in one place to try to determine what it is. If we do that, we're going to miss the big picture. If all we do are look at these data points, it seems to me it's very much like walking into a room with our eyes closed. I'll give you one point. You touch it in one place and tell me what it is.
I'll give you one data point. You tell me what the thing is. You know, you've heard that story, right? You can't tell. If it's in the trunk, it's one thing. The tusk is something else. You can't tell. You can't see the forest for the trees. If all we looked at was home computer sales, cell phones, internet online services, we'd miss the big picture, arguably something like this. The next big thing, probably, all probability. The wearable stuff, you're already starting to see that. You're already probably wearing a computer if you're carrying a cell phone. Stephen Mann at the University of Toronto has been pioneering this stuff, this concept for quite a while. 1980, he was like 16 years old, wearing a TV set on his head. Getting very Borg-like during his graduate studies in the early 90s. But finally, in the late 90s, he's a full professor now at the University of Toronto. Looks very much like Nicolas Cage on a bad day. You see the glasses?
Those are not just regular glasses. Didn't you ever see the movie The Terminator with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
I'll be back.
Did you see that?
Those are net-enabled. He can superimpose network derived data onto reality. He can augment reality with that. You see that on his belt? It's not just a pager. It's not a cell phone. It's his ability to be a web client. It can even be a web server.
When the camera let you see the world from the Terminator's point of view, do you remember? The world wasn't just the world, but there was data over the top of the world. You could see the data overlaid on top of reality. This is a notion we call augmented reality. What if your glasses could give you an internet connection?
He had a distinct competitive advantage over every other person who had ever gone for a PhD at MIT because he was able to connect, because he was able to wear this psychic amplifier and take it everywhere with him.
What if, for example, you're a student and you go to hear your professor's lecture? Would it give you some advantage to be able to have lecture notes or related things that you could view at the same time? What if you meet someone that you remember but you can't remember their name? Would it give you some advantage to be able to access a database instantly?
Now, would that add value? If you had that, would that add value? Let me ask that another way. If your competitor had that, where would you be?
In statistics, the median point of any set is the middle value. Half the population will be greater than the median. Half will be less.
I think this is what got me in trouble in Austin. I just want to apologize because I mean no harm. And I got this, by the way, from ilovebacon.com. Little plug there. And I certainly don't want to disparage the memory of Mo Howard. Okay. So, who I think was a very brilliant man. Mo Howard was brilliant, in my opinion. I have put up here what I called Goff's Law. And please, I want to apologize again for this. Everybody's got a law. I got a law. I told my son this as he was walking out the door, ready to go to college. I said, son, never forget, half of the people in this world are below median intelligence. Okay? Now, that's definitional. No matter how you measure it, it's definitional. It's simply based on our notion of what we call statistics. Okay? That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying with this. Please forgive me. But if you're a software developer and you understand that, and you understand maybe some of the implications of that, maybe that'll make a difference. Maybe that'll make a difference. Because you know you got to keep things simple for one thing. There's other implications as well. If you think about Metcalfe's law, if you think about the potential value of the network, we do not get there until we have maximum number of nodes, right? The more nodes we have, the more potential value. That means everybody on the planet. Everybody, if we're going to really utilize all these resources to the best that they are, everybody's got to get connected here. It means it's got to be real cheap. Because you know what? Most of the people on the planet can't afford it. Half of the adults on our planet can't read. Okay? It's got to be simple. Goff's Law.
If God does not exist, one will lose nothing by believing in Him. While if He does exist, one will lose everything by not believing. These sage words summarize a logical belief system espoused by one Blaise Pascal, the great 17th century mathematician and philosopher, for whom the Pascal programming language was named. Borrowing from Pascal's logic, Dr. Robert Costanza, director of the University of Maryland's Institute for the Study of Ecological Economics, has proposed a shared visions model for the year 2100.
I'm a member of the World Future Society. I get their magazine on a regular basis. I pulled this out of one of their issues last year. Robert Costanza at the University of Maryland Institute for Ecological Economics. Talking about shared visions and the importance of a shared vision. And I just wanted to share this with you because I thought it was kind of important. What was cool about it from my perspective was the thing on the left there. Because what it does is encapsulate what we might call belief. What is it we believe, and that's the essence of a vision, juxtaposed to what is the true state of things. And this is what Dr. Costanza talked about in terms of the four visions for the year 2100, 100 years from now.
Costanza's model would have us consider world economic policies and their underlying attitudes toward technology. Such attitudes can be characterized by the word belief. For simplicity, underlying attitudes are considered to be either optimistic or skeptical when it comes to the potential of technology and our ability to utilize it successfully to address world problems. That belief axis, when juxtaposed to the actual state of reality, which can only unfold over time, serves to illustrate some interesting global possibilities.
Technological optimisms. Our resources are unlimited. That is one of the quadrants. If you believe that the technology can solve virtually any of our problems, then really open markets are the way to do that. That's kind of one belief system. Another belief system is, I'm kind of skeptical here. Our resources aren't limited. Technology can't solve anything. We need more community stuff. We need more policy and that sort of thing. That's the other belief quadrant. So if you are an optimist, if we are optimists, if we take that point of view and we're right, that's the future. 100 years from now, we're looking at Star Trek. Fusion energy is practical. It solves a lot of our ecological and all our eco problems, ecological, economic. And we start to take off to the inner solar system. We inherit the world. We inherit the universe. That's if we're optimistic and that's right. according to Costanza, that's what we get. If we're skeptical and we're right, the payoff is ectopia. Tax reforms are favoring eco-beneficent industries, punishing the polluters. We're doing the right thing by the planet because we know we have limited resources and we're all working together. And if we all are skeptical and we're right, that's what we get. So it's kind of good in either way. Either way, it's kind of good because we're right. But if we guess wrong, Mad Max, oil production declines, no affordable alternatives, financial markets collapse, governments weaken, the world is run by transnational corporations. If we're skeptical and we're wrong, worst case, according to Costanza, big government. Government slows things down. We don't get the technology developed as quickly as we possibly can. This is all kind of interesting, and it really doesn't work out that way, does it? I mean, there's no one of these that we're all going to go in anyway, so it doesn't really matter. I think what interested me was two things. First of all, the function of belief. The function of belief itself. I'm a believer in belief. The other thing I thought was interesting was that the two poles of idealism are both really software on the inside. That you have to have software on the inside for either one of those to work. So that any direction that we move in with respect to belief in world policy and resources and all that, it requires what we do. And when you stop and think about 6 billion people on our planet plus, if only 14 million of us are software developers, that's less than 0.25% of humanity, and half of us are doing Visual Basic still. So that's an awesome amount of responsibility on our shoulders, an awesome amount. Especially if what I said earlier was true. If there's hope for humanity, it's in software. Oh my goodness. We've all got responsibility for a whole lot of people here.
Just as Pascal's model serves as a tool for considering optimal strategy in the implementation of one's faith, Costanza's shared vision helps us to understand the risks and rewards of betting humanity's future on technology. As with Pascal, Costanza's model gives rise to considerable implications for software development, some of which cannot be ignored.